Hello and welcome to Mansplaining. I'm Stephen Kersner. Today we're going to examine how chauvinist are we? Because as though our panelists all consider ourselves to be fairly progressive people and very egalitarian, there's still got to be some vestiges of chauvinism in us. Not necessarily negative chauvinism, but situations where we treat men and women differently. And we're going to examine our attitudes today, as we usually do on this program. Joining me, boy, do we have a cast today. We've got our producer, Hafiz Nirani. Hello, Hafiz.
Hello, hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. We've got Aaron Seal joining us. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, sir.
And we've got Chris Illtones joining us.
What's going on, man?
Good to have you. Byron Rutledge, are you pulled over again or are you at home?
I'm sitting in the truck stop in Hope currently.
Oh, okay. In Hope, Ontario or...?
British Columbia.
Hope, British Columbia. I've never heard of it. That's why I was wondering. Okay.
They filmed First Blood here. You know where it is.
I love the assumption. Okay. Okay.
Hope, BC is the unofficial capital of British Columbia.
It is?
If you're unofficial. On the other side of Hope, if you're east of Hope, you're beyond Hope as far as we're concerned.
Oh, boy. I knew that was coming. Okay. Also joining us, we heard him there, Paul Doroshenko. Hello, Paul.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you. And joining us again, Andrew Willis. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. Okay. That's an odd tack you're taking there. I understand that you have a new job this week, do you?
You know what I do? I work out at a horse farm now out in Alberta. Every morning I put on a little Jan Arden and get out there and get a little bit muddy, and I love it.
All right. That's just pregnant with opportunities for comment, but I'm just going to leave it as it is. All right. Let's examine our own remaining vestiges of chauvinism. And I'm sure that some of us will cross over and we'll have the same vestiges, but that's okay. Even if somebody's spoken before you and said so, you can bring up the exact same one because that will make its own point in and of itself. All right, you know, we'll start with Paul Doroshenko. Paul,
you know, I prefer to wait till everybody else is done.
All right,
let's tips. But no, you can start with me. You can start with me.
Well, after you started with whining like that, I figured I'll go to somebody else.
I'll do my best. Let me tell you. The one thing that I can identify and that every other people did identify when I started polling them this week, when you put the question out, was I interrupt women. I try not to. I'm told that I do it. And it's just one of those things that I'm perpetually trying to stop myself from doing.
Okay. Is this you interrupt women more than you interrupt men?
Well, I'm told that I do. It's very hard for me to measure it. I never feel that I'm doing it when I'm doing it, but
I'm an equal opportunity interrupter.
Yeah. I like to think that I am, but I don't know.
Well, maybe he's just like proved it.
So the, I work in an office with four female lawyers, five female legal assistants and me. I just realized today I'm the only guy in the downtown office right now. And so, anything else that I would do, I would probably correct myself fairly quickly, but that's one thing that I do that's negative, that's, that I am working on correcting. Now, okay. I also open doors and things like that. I still carry most things that are heavy, but I don't, not exclusively. Sometimes I've got assistants here. I ask them to come and help me carry things into the office occasionally. So it's not, female assistants. So I don't think I'm, singularly there with the only guy who's got the muscle to do the heavy lifting. But I think that's basically the things that I can identify. Not very exciting, but
there's a discussion we had there, which we'll get to after we get through everybody else. Okay, I'll go next to Aaron. Aaron, what vestiges of chauvinism have you identified in yourself?
So this topic struck a chord with me because, as some of you know, I went through a severe depression through my mid-30s, lasted a few years. And as I was coming out of it, I went through a phase where I really examined the first half of my life, examined the things that people had said about me, the things that I'd done, the memories that I had. And I cataloged what I classified into moments that I felt a need to apologize for. However large or small, and also questionable moments where I understood the perspective of whoever it might have been that would have been faulting me, but I also understood mine. And the line that I ended up using was, I'm willing to apologize and acknowledge fault for anything I've done, but I will also tell my side of the story. And I would hope that my side would be heard just as I'm willing to hear the other one. So some of the examples, like back in university, we used to make bad jokes and like it was almost no holds barred. Like we'd make fun of ourselves and we'd make fun of others. And sometimes our personal sensitivities were not as calibrated as you would want them to be for an adult. Like we were all young. And in some moments there were some, like when a bad joke flops, it can flop really badly. So I've offered apologies. And if anybody else remembers moments that are sort of cringeworthy, I'm happy to go there. And there are also sort of toxic masculinity customs, like the drinking customs at Queens were not good. There were pressure within the male communities. And there were pressure, I've witnessed pressure by men on women to drink. And to the extent that I was a part of that, I'll apologize for that too.
So you're saying that there was, that the drinking culture extended to men, not just cajoling other men to drink with them as a rite of passage or as a type of bonding, but also men then coercing women to drink as well. Is that what you're saying?
There was pressure to drink. There was pressure to drink for a variety of reasons. It was Queen's culture is getting it. Like, over the last decade, it's become well known that the party culture at Queen's has become toxic over the course of decades. What in, I guess, the 20th century was a relatively harmless party school turned into cars being flipped over and burned at homecoming parties on the street back in 2005. There was a St. Patrick's Day party in 2018 that went crazy. None of this is directly chauvinism, but when you get drinking heavy environments like that, you can only imagine the gendered consequences. So if I look back, like there were moments that were fun, but there are moments that I look back and I say, I kind of wish I wasn't a part of that. And to the extent that I need to offer apologies, I both have and I'm willing to do so. The other side of the coin that I alluded to is I can identify some stories where despite my willingness to acknowledge my own side of things, I also have my own perspective that I believe warrants being heard. And one example from the workplace that I identified over the years was I had a subordinate who was credentialed. She was a woman, obviously, but she was also older than me. So the confluence of factors came together, combined with the fact that I was a direct supervisor, to create an awkward environment. And the moment of tension, like I remember it night as day, the quote that she called me out on was, I used the words, we have to get smart on this. And my intention was to communicate that I didn't feel like we understood a file and that we needed to figure it out. But she interpreted it as a slight on her skills. I believe that was a lost in translation moment. It's the type of thing that I'm willing to apologize for, but I also am willing to defend my honor to say my intent had nothing to do with the way it came off. I will acknowledge fault, but I also believe that my side should be respected. So that's the kind of perspective I take on this. I'm willing to be self-critical as much as anybody wants me to be, and I will offer apologies, but there are some moments that I will also defend.
Okay. Let's go to Byron. Byron, your last vestiges of chauvinism that creep out from time to time.
For me, sadly to say, it didn't take me long to think of this. I work in a very male-dominated industry, especially when I was logging. And you get the occasional woman that comes into the industry. And I always had that first thought when I initially see them doing the job. Is like, oh, I wonder if they can handle it. And it is because they're a woman, not because they're not good at it. It's just that vestige of that thinking from how I was taught growing up and whatnot. And that's one thing that I've really been trying to work on in the last few years.
I mean, just basically because there's attitudes that there's some industries that physically women aren't cut out for, as if each, as if women all have one body type. And so you're saying that that sort of inborn attitude got you questioning whether the woman was there based on merit or based on some political consideration?
Yeah.
Okay. And you were continuing.
I'm working on trying to change that. Like I try and keep it conscious all the time and not let it get to me.
All right. And was there another point that you, or is that the main point?
That's the main one I can think of.
Okay. let's move on to Chris. You work in a pretty male-dominated industry, too.
I do, yeah, but the one that sticks out to me has nothing to do with the industry that I work in. I still watch pornography. And so that, to me, is why, I mean, there's no deeper objectification of women than in pornography. It's about as far as it goes. But having said that, my saving grace and something that makes it a little less chauvinist is that I'm bisexual. So there may be some, you know, penises and vaginas popping up from time to time. And I pay special attention to each. But it doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't carry over into my regular everyday life when I'm in public and a beautiful woman might happen to walk by and I, you know, kind of do the head turn and check her out as she's walking past. That stuff is still in my life. But
what's wrong with that?
I don't know if there's anything wrong with it or not, because that doesn't mean like this woman who passes me by can't be like a neuroscientist or whatever, you know, like more power to her if she is. But it is,
there's anything chauvinistic about having an attraction to the opposite sex. It's how, it's what you do with it that determines whether it's chauvinistic or not.
Totally. I would agree with you there, but I know there are people out there who would view porno as being the most chauvinist thing that you could
do. You know what? I'm gonna disagree with you on that for the reasons that I have experience dealing with people in the pornography industry. You know, with the Ed the Sock Show, we were on a lot of porn sets and met a lot of porn performers. And quite frankly, the women that are not there because they're jonesing for their next fix of heroin. These women are professional. They're doing a job. They know exactly what the job is. They don't do anything they don't want to do. And women are paid far more money in pornography than men are. So this old notion that women have to be taken advantage of in order for them to be involved in porn, that I think is a chauvinist attitude. It doesn't really reflect the reality of pornography today, where women have a great deal of power and are very professional about what they do. This isn't 70s porn where they were both men and women were strung out most of the time. And this isn't a business where they're doing it to get their next fix and they're being taken advantage of. They're being well paid. It's legitimate sex work. And the notion that watching pornography is degrading to women, I think, is a vestige of chauvinism.
I went to the Adult Video Network conference in Las Vegas about a decade and a half ago.
Me too.
One of my colleagues wanted to get into something connected with it. She was a bookkeeper and was also a bookkeeper for a online pharmacy, and they found that dildos and porn sold really well. So we went to this event in Las Vegas, and I spent days there wandering around and talking to these women who were in porn. And I looked at it as a bit of an anthropological exercise. I was interested in why, you know, how they got there, you know, what their view is of it and how they, you know, view themselves. And just like all of them seemed to have a very good understanding of their role. They were not like drug users or anything like that. They were all, you know, made this conscious decision to get into this industry. Their families knew about it and everything. They had laid it all out. This is what they were doing, and they were going to make money for a period of time. Some of them were paying for university. That, you know, none of them were prostitutes or anything like that. So I went down there with an assumption about them, and my assumption about them was that they were going to be women who were being exploited. And I came back with the realization that these were people making decisions in their lives that made sense for them. And my assumptions were chauvinistic, frankly.
Yeah, just to be clear, I'm not, I wasn't trying to imply that every woman who appears in a pornography film is, or a pornographic film is like, you know, doing it because she has low self-esteem and whatever. That's that wasn't what I was implying.
No, but it's the, you're implying the concern about, that many people have in our society, that this objectification of women is chauvinistic, and by patronizing it, that you are doing something chauvinistic. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that there's people who take that too far. You know, I'm with Stephen on this one. I think it relies on a fundamental misunderstanding of the industry.
And I think that there's plenty of objectification of men in those businesses, because if you've got an average penis, you don't have a chance. So there, you know, the dangers of objectification of men do not have the same societal ramifications as the objectification of women does. But the idea that it's an industry where women are exploited or anything like that, they're fully aware what they're doing and are usually the ones wielding the power. In fact, when I dealt with pornography companies, and I dealt with the higher end ones, the women, the people I dealt with, the management people and so on, were always women. And they were all very professional. Like nothing felt, it didn't feel dirty or sleazy. So it changed my idea of porn completely. Okay, and now, save for the last, Andy Willis, what kind of chauvinism do you engage in without really intending to?
I think it's really important that we understand the distinction of the term chauvinism, and that chauvinism is not exclusive to men not approving women, but chauvinism is basically some sort of patriotism or irrational superiority complex that could be about race, it could be about religion, it could be about being a man, and
nationalism. I think
nationalism, yeah, absolutely. So one thing I don't think we've touched on is chauvinism towards trans people, and this is something that quite personally I reflected on with Jack Halberstam, who is a academic in the States at Columbia University, who published a book called Trans Asterisk. And prior to interviewing Jack, I sent this email where I kind of said, you know, there was a time where I, as a gay male, and a lot of my gay male counterparts thought of trans, or at least my friends, thought of trans people as sort of like freakish, as like, you know, secondhand, as not, you know, there's not a hatred, but a dislike, a feeling of superiority, that there is, that there, you know, there's gays, there's lesbians, but then trans were like these weird objects, these oddities in between. So I spoke openly to Jack, who's an academic, who is trans, who, you know, and I said, you know, I want to talk about this and figure out where this phenomenon comes from. But of course, it comes from visibility and how trans people are portrayed. So I would say that a majority of my chauvinism didn't have to do necessarily with women. I feel like that is not, what is it called, exclusive to being gay. I think because my family largely was raised by women, very dominant women, we have quite a lot of respect towards women. But towards trans women, I found myself to be very confused early on, and of course now that's definitely transformed and changed. So that is where my chauvinism lies.
I said that I left Andy for last, but I actually left Hafiz for last.
No, you went by me. It's fine. Okay.
Did I go by you?
No, you didn't. No, you just skipped me entirely. I don't exist.
Oh, here we go. He's talking about erasure now. All right, Hafiz. I just, you talk so much in the earlier.
My emotions feel chauvinistically oppressed here. Anyway,
talk so much in the early part of the show. I assumed that I'd gone to you.
Yeah, that was my opinion. Yeah,
okay, absolutely. Now let's hear your true confessions.
For me, as the vestiges of chauvinism, I think that I still see. I think if there were a group of men, whether it were in a business setting or in a bar setting, the conversation could be vastly different compared to if there was a woman in the room, or you know, a conversation with a mixed group of men and women. Maybe not so much at the bar. At the bar, I think that would definitely go in a similar direction. But in the business place, now this is not so much me, it's just something I noticed from working in the corporate world and whatnot. Whenever there's a meeting of, like, let's say four or five guys versus a meeting of two women that are also senior business people, it's vastly different. And I think there is still a vestige of sort of an old boys club mentality. And it doesn't matter what your race is, it still comes out there. This notion of this business type, this megalomaniac wannabe mentality that most people in the business world kind of see on a television style thing, this attitude. But people try to bring that out in the real world too. You get a little bit, you see some guys with a little bit of money, and all of a sudden they're a hot shot, right? And sometimes they express it with what they drive and what they spend at the bar. But there's also a little bit of that lingo in the boardrooms.
I kind of understand. I don't think I understand what the hell you just said.
We speak differently around each other as men than we would like in a bar, than we would in an office with a bunch of women around. So,
thank you for here, Chris, to decode my fees.
He deciphered me. There you go.
I did, yeah, for sure.
I need a translator on this show, and
I'm around rappers. I'm around rappers all day, and they all speak in code, so I have to decipher that because I'm
Well done.
A little bit differently than them. So yeah, I broke the Hafiz code.
Yeah, it was like
there you go.
I felt like I was trailing Billy's path through the yard in those Family Circus cartoons. but Hafiz brings up an interesting point via Chris, which is how men talk differently amongst themselves and amongst women. I know that, I mean, I haven't been around groups of people in quite some time, but I know that when I did, I was always slow. I wouldn't tell dirty jokes in front of women.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, dirty jokes is a big one.
Yeah, I just wouldn't tell dirty jokes in front, even though these women might themselves tell dirty jokes with the rest of us. I just felt that it was improper to tell dirty jokes around women that I might tell around men. And I mean, that is not treating women equally. That is chauvinistic. And
to assume that they would not find it funny. But this is it, right? Because I have female friends that love dirty jokes and that I have I'm totally fine telling a dirty joke around. But if it was in a group and someone said a dirty joke and there's, it's a mixed crowd, I'm less likely to follow up with another dirty joke. But if it's a room full of guys, there's a shit ton of dirty jokes going on.
Yeah, okay, let's go around the horn here and see how everybody else feels. Paul, how do you feel about telling dirty jokes when women are present?
I've made jokes that are bad to basically expose and joke about toxic masculinity. So there's been many times that I've made a joke purely just to joke about the fact that jokes are sometimes offside or whatever. There was one day I walked into one of my colleague's offices and I had to order some new business cards for her. And I knew her business cards were in a box in the top drawer of her desk. And I walked into her office and I was just flustered, right? Because I had to make this order right away. And I walked into her office and I said, show me your box, box of business cards. And so that became a joke around the office for the longest time. Anytime, something was shipped in. It wasn't just me, it was other people were doing it too. But I mean, it was a joke on the joke, right? That's not necessarily the best example, but you know, there's times that we make jokes that are too.
Can that be the next t-shirt from you guys? Show me your box.
Yeah. It was funny.
Acumen Law, show me your box.
You can imagine when I realized what I was saying that my eyes got, you know, three times as large as normal. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I said that.
All right.
Let's
go. Aaron Seal, do you feel uncomfortable telling dirty jokes around women that you'd tell around men?
Well, this isn't one thing that I would generalize across women as a category, because I know some women who absolutely love body humor is maybe a term I'd use, and who can give it as well as they can laugh at it. But I've learned over the years to know my audience. And this is something you learn by fire. You make one joke that'll provoke great laughter with one person, and it'll just fall completely flat and kill the mood with another. So I am able to enjoy a dirty joke. I made plenty of dirty jokes myself, and I know people who make ones that I absolutely love, but I've learned over time to be careful with this type of thing.
Okay. Byron?
It all depends if the joke is sexist or not, really. If a dirty joke...
If it's just dirty but not sexist, you're okay, equally male and female?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. And Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I've relaxed this over time too. I used to worry about it a little bit, but last night, in fact, I was on a date with a very, very shy Indigenous lady. And so I didn't know really what the etiquette was going to be surrounding this exact topic. And we came back to my place after dinner and we were just flipping through cable on the digital cable, and Octopussy was on some channel like AMC or whatever it was, the Bond film. Mm-hmm. And I just said, "Oh, Octopussy." And I didn't even need to make the joke. She just immediately shot back, "Sounds like a porno." And then I said, "With an underwater theme." And it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And I had worried about like things like this just because of how shy she was. And it surprised me when she shot back with the, you know, the sexual innuendo that I was hoping that she would project back to me or whatever. So yeah, it was really nice. I guess I will make those jokes occasionally, but yeah, I do walk on eggshells a little bit surrounding that topic. And I guess that is a little bit of chauvinism in itself, the fact that I would speak differently of around females in comparison to how I would speak around men.
I don't think I even need to ask Andy. Andy, do you find dirty jokes that you won't tell to women that you will tell to men?
Well, first of all, my motto is the world is big enough, so stop walking on eggshells and take up some space. And then second to that, you know, anything with humor, it's like you're always on the edge and being comfortable being on the edge, but never falling off. You know, the big thing is about delivery and tone. So I make chauvinist jokes all the time. And I do it in a way where it's the tone is that it's not that I'm saying it from a place of superiority or hatred or fact or that, hey, guys, like, don't you feel the same way? It's more that I'm making it because it's so ridiculous to make a joke like that nowadays. So a good example of that is me, and my friend Emily. She's my wife, first of all. She's like I love her. She's just there for me every day. And so we'll make jokes all the time. Like, you know, I'll say to her, I'll be like, "Oh, well, geez, Emily, like, you know, like, it's probably because you're a woman. They don't want you to, like, you know, work there." And, you know, and she laughs, you know, and it's like, it's, you have to have that relational aspect in your humor. Otherwise, if you don't have that, then it's just going to fall flat. Like, I would never make a joke like that to someone in the workplace who I don't really know all that deeply. But yeah, with my friend Emily, we do that all the time. And she'll say things to me. She'll be like, "Oh, well, they probably did it because you're gay, Andrew." And I'm like, "Oh," you know, so we laugh. Like, so I think, yes, I do make those jokes, and I make them with people who I can relate to, and they get my worldview, and they understand that I'm not a raging chauvinist. And that's a good place to be.
But would you make those same jokes with women who you don't know all that well as you would with men who you don't know all that well?
Yes, actually, and I have. And, you know, I do. And I think there's nothing wrong with, I haven't had any negative feedback about it because, again, I'm very good about timing. I'm very good about reading a room, and I've never had an issue with it. And of course, if I were to have an issue with it, I'd be very cautious. I'm a very cautious person. I'm also a very litigious person, so I can understand the room for fault and error. So, you know, but
do you think that you have more license as a gay male to say things that women won't take offense to, that a heterosexual male they might take offense to?
You know, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately, and I underscore that I do. And the reason why I say that is because I really examined quite extensively how gay men are often toxic towards women. But also towards trans women, you know. I do think, unfortunately, there is a license. So it's very important that when you do have some form of privilege or ability, that you take very good care of it and caution it and temper it.
Okay, now here's a follow-up question. Do any of you have concerns that making a dirty joke in front of a woman could get you in trouble with a sexual harassment complaint? Paul?
Absolutely. I was just thinking about the human rights complaint. You know, Andrew's probably going to avoid it, but if I was to make something like that, you know, guaranteed there's a risk that you take. And it's usually not worth it. And often enough, the joke is, you know, you never know how it's going to be read. You never know how the audience is going to take it. You never know what's offended them in the past. But I'm always concerned about that. I'm doing my best not to offend people. I still like to be funny. But yeah, it's a risk you take, and I don't want to end up in front of a human rights tribunal trying to explain my joke.
Okay. Can I just quickly interrupt? Because a lot of that is, and Paul can explain this, it's not about not about intent, it's all about perception. And maybe, Paul, you can kind of explain that.
No, you just did. It's really, that's the issue. You may have no intent to offend anyone or to make anybody uncomfortable. But if they are uncomfortable and, you know, you're in a situation where you're having to explain yourself, often your explanation, you know, you never know how it's going to be read by whoever's making the decision in the end.
All right, Aaron, is this ever a concern of yours?
Oh, 100%. Like some of you talked about walking on eggshells, and I'm with Paul. Like, as much as we might not want to walk on eggshells, we kind of have to, especially like Paul, I can imagine in a legal setting, me when I was in politics, you always have to think twice, though that's the term I'll use, think twice. About the words that you're saying, the message you're conveying, especially when you're trafficking in things like jokes and innuendo. Now, sometimes you'll do it anyway. Those of you who follow me on social media will know back in the early part of this year when the conservative leadership race was at its apex, I was tweeting up a storm and I was trading in innuendo. And in some moments, I was acutely aware of what I was saying and the possibility that in polite company, I might be stepping on some social toes, but in some moments I chose to do it anyway because I was either exploiting the impact of the words I was using, or I was just saying, look, that's not the message I'm trying to convey. That'll draw attention, but I'm trying to convey a different message and I'm willing to use shock value to amplify my broadcast impact. So like I say, it's a think twice impact. I definitely think twice. I can't avoid the eggshells, but sometimes I will lean into the joke anyway.
All right, Byron?
Well, it really depends on the setting I'm in. If I'm in a professional setting in an office dealing with customers, that all that stuff just goes out the window and I am as professional as possible. I won't crack certain jokes unless I know the audience 100% that I'm delivering the joke to, just to avoid this kind of thing. If I'm ever in doubt, nah, just keep it to yourself.
All right, Hafiz?
Professional settings, I try to avoid that path altogether, whether it's men or women. And the reason being, I find that once you get into sort of a more joking relationship and whatnot, especially when in my line of work, it's usually working with other people that are providing services for my clients, right? I like to maintain a certain relationship in a professional setting that is professional. That, you know, might joke around a little bit, but not to that level. That level is an outside joke. And honestly, outside, whether it's on social media or in person, and someone's offended by something I say, I couldn't give two shits.
All right. And Chris, do you ever concern yourself about somebody seeing something as sexual harassment when you make a dirty joke in front of women?
I think I'm of the same opinion as Paul is, actually. Definitely in the workplace, like I have a professional career outside of hip hop as well. I used to manage an office of the sales variety here in Nanaimo where I live. And definitely in that context, like I, you know, would conduct job interviews and train new employees and stuff like that. And certainly can't make those jokes with new hires or even people who have been there for quite some time, because all it takes is one person who feels uncomfortable and becomes a legal issue. So yeah, I do walk on eggshells in that context and a little bit outside of it. Like I really don't like making people feel uncomfortable. So like Andrew said, I'm pretty good at reading a room. And so if I think it's the right time, then it's the right time. And if it's not, I'll refrain.
Okay. Paul brought up something earlier, which was that he says he interrupts women, and then went on to tell us that his office is pretty much all women, which means that it's hard to gauge whether he's interrupting women more than men, because there's really not men there. I wonder whether sometimes the way women have been acculturated is to be more quiet and subservient. And I don't say this is a good thing. I say it's a bad thing. But women are not taught to be aggressive in the way that they speak. I think that I've found situations where, yes, I interrupt people talking, but I find that when I interrupt men, men will just keep going or they'll interrupt me right back. Whereas a woman will withdraw. And that, I think, is the very is the difference between the impact of whether you're interrupting a man or a woman. I wonder, how do you feel about that thought, Aaron?
That's fascinating, frankly, and I think you're absolutely right as I think about it, because I was actually going to interrupt you as you were saying that, because that is absolutely my instinct. If somebody challenges me, I will challenge them back. And you are right. If I think through some examples from my Parliament Hill years, there are definitely examples where that instinct on my part saying, I'll give it, I want you to give it right back, take it and give it in exchange, that's not well received among some women. Now, there are other examples. One of my favorite women from my government years was a woman named Nyaprak Baltajoglu, who was in her last role, the secretary, the lead bureaucrat of the Treasury Board, who was of Turkish upbringing. And like she, you could almost nickname her the Turkish police, because if she had something she needed to advance, like you're not getting in her way. She can take it like she could give it. And we got along beautifully because that instinct of hers was mirrored in me. And I agree, Stephen, that that's not always the case. But you're right that there is a gender difference there. I think it's also a Western issue, because I think it is, in some sense, a Western women's instinct to withdraw when challenged rather than rise. But I'm with you, Stephen, that my male instinct is the same as yours.
Okay. Part of my problem is that, you know, there is an advantage for me, and it's for my client, for me to exploit this. You know, you've identified the mechanism here, Stephen. Yes, women have been enculturated to this, but if I'm dealing with a female prosecutor or a female government employee and I need to get something done, you know, I'm in a situation where I have to get something done for my client. And should I be exploiting the fact that I know that I can interrupt and talk over and force my way through just because I, you know, it's something that's available to me? And am I doing a disservice for my client if I don't do that in circumstances where I can gain that advantage for my client? And that's where it becomes more problematic for me.
Yeah,
because I don't want to be interrupting people, and I don't want to be an asshole, and I don't want to be an asshole for the purpose of work, right? Or even for my clients. But, you know, my job is to do my best job I possibly can for my clients.
I think that lawyers are paid to be assholes. At least I pay mine for that. But I can see the quandary that you're in, which is rather unique to your circumstances. Byron, do you find that the issue of interrupting, you do it the same with men and women? Or do you find that you do it more with women? Or is it just more of an issue with women?
Well, for me personally, I interrupt everybody because that's just the way I am. And it's something I have to work on in general, not so much specifically for men or women. But I do think that culturally and societally, women are taught to be meek, especially if you look at how the media treats how women behave versus how men behave. Joe Biden can tell Trump to shut up, but Hillary Clinton couldn't. Or she'd be shrill and all this kind of stuff. And I think, you know, you're fed that information growing up as a woman, and it just kind of becomes just part of your internal dialogue, I guess.
That's interesting. Interesting. How about you, Chris?
Again, I agree with Paul. In the context of work, I have to interrupt people all the time. I work in the sales industry, and while the motto is the customer is always right, the customer is usually wrong. And so I don't really want them speaking too much when I'm trying to conduct a sale. I take the steamroll approach, and it does involve interrupting people all the time. So I'll cut people off politely. I generally want them to listening to my pitch rather than fielding questions. And so in that context, I interrupt people all the time, and it's to the betterment of my business and the clients that I work on behalf of, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, in that context, I do it. Outside of my work, I am not a big...
Let me just ask you, though, within the context of your work, and I recognize I interrupted, do you find that there's any difference in the response when you interrupt men versus women?
Not so much. No, I'm, I guess in that context, I'm a fairly astute interrupter. And so I don't really get cut off in return too often. But outside of work, no, I don't notice any difference with it. Maybe I just haven't paid attention to it really. But outside of work, I just don't do it really. So I can't really speak on that level. But yeah, workplace, I'll do it for sure. And it's because my my job and my business depends on being able to do it to some extent.
Okay. Hafiz?
In terms of interruptions, like at the workplace?
Do you notice that, I'm going to assume that you probably interrupt men and women equally, that you're not...
Like I said, I'm an equal opportunity interrupter.
Do you find that there is a different response when you interrupt women versus interrupting men?
It depends on what I'm interrupting them for. If it's usually someone that's a subordinate that's telling me some long-winded story of why they can't do something, and I interrupt them, no, it's the same. It's usually the same look. If it's someone that believes that I've offended them, it's completely different. But I've had men be offended by me interrupting them, actually more so than women. I find though, like I've in a social situations, I find if I interrupt a woman, I kind of stop, apologize, and will try to divert the conversation back so that she can finish what she was saying. With a man, I don't give a fuck.
But do you find that the man will do that on his own? Will come back as if he hadn't been interrupted and continue where he was, whereas a woman will feel thrown off?
Well, again, it really depends on the man. Some men will, and they'll make it a point of referencing that you've interrupted them as though you've created some huge wrong against them. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't think men will most likely usually come back to the thing. But usually a woman, I find if I've interrupted a woman or something, that point may be lost forever unless I go back to that.
Interesting. Okay. Byron, did we go to you on this question?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you did.
Okay. Well, that's what happens when I have so many panelists. Sometimes by the time I get through the fourth or fifth one, I forget if I've gone to the first one. I know that I have not gone to Andy on this.
Yeah. Well, just the name, if you had met me like 4 years ago, I would be like really quiet with, you know, I wouldn't be jumping in. I wouldn't be interrupting anybody.
I don't believe that.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah.
I refuse to believe that.
I need proof.
No,
I refuse to believe that.
Like, I was very loud in my opinion, but I wasn't articulate enough. And you know what really changed that for me? It was truly broadcasting.
Are you sure you weren't hit by lightning?
I was hit by, yeah, you know what? In my own inside joke way, yes, I was hit by lightning. But with what I do, the nature of what I do, I cannot let someone, if I'm interviewing them or speaking with them or whatever, I can't let them go off topic. People like to give 10-minute answers and I need like a 30-second minute answer. So I'm continuously cutting people off, or I'm throwing to something else, or there's like an audio post I have to hit. So I have to be like, okay, and then just talk over someone and start wrapping it up. So because of that, it's caused me to be an excellent interrupter of people. This has really bothered Emily, but I've continuously had to explain to her like, no, like it's just how it's done. A really interesting thing that happened the other day, I was having dinner with some friends from Global and they're on-air talent, and And you should see how when three people who are on-air talent sit together around a table and talk, it is insane. Uh-huh. It is insane because you'll say something and all of a sudden you'll know when to stop and then they'll pick up. And it's like there's never like anyone over talking or it's just it's perfect. It's really freaking hilarious. But one thing that I want to comment on is Savannah Guthrie. She was the one that was hosting the town hall with Trump. And she was really good at kind of saying like, I need to stop you here. I need to stop. And that was really great. And that's actually a talent that I learned from someone, was having to say in a situation where you're getting bulldozed or someone's just talking over you or they're talking and you don't want to talk about something, just to say, I'm going to have to stop you here, or I'm going to have to stop you right here. We're not going to do this. And when you do that, it's amazing how even the most aggressive male or even female will actually stop.
I think the point we're making is not that women will stop, but that they do stop, whereas men keep going. And so women feel derailed by interruptions far more than men do. And have you ever encountered that?
Yeah, I have encountered it. And like, you know, not to sound really cold, but my whole thing is like, I don't care. I have my own objective I need to get to. And if I don't get there, move out of my way. But when it comes to like, but then I have to temper that, right? So that's something Jack Halberstam, told me, was like, you have to temper your strengths. And I'm like, why? That's going to make you weak. That sucks. And they were like, no, you have to do this. So when I'm in a room with people who aren't in broadcasting and may take 10 minutes to give you a reply, the best thing you can do is just let them. You know, I'm not there to train them to be something that they're not. And, you know, it's not going to be collaborative. And to make space, like if I know that I'm talking a lot, which I'm kind of doing right now, this is a long bit, but just to say, you know, yeah, just to give room to other people to talk. And that's something that Emily told me. We had a big heart to heart yesterday, and she said, Andrew, you don't let women talk and you talk over them in the classroom. And I didn't notice it. And I said, well, you know, this is probably just because of who I am. I just don't like when people talk so long and it's like, I have a point I need to get to. And she's like, well, just let them. So that's something I'm working on now.
Do you think you do that more to women than to men, or do you think women take exception to it more than men?
I haven't done an analysis, but I will say, if you let me bulldoze through you, I will. Like, I am not the type of person to stop because, you know, I mean, saying this very cautiously, but also in the abstract, it's like, I'm very, like, if you're going to let me talk, I'll talk, is what I'm basically saying, you know? So has that been more women than men? No, because I, you know,
give the man a mic, he'll give you a concert, is what he's trying to get at.
Yes. Okay.
But be mindful, like not to talk a lot, but yeah, I mean, no, there's a lot of people who really don't give a fuck about thinking and speaking and articulating or anything, and they just like don't really care. So in that case, I'm going to say, great, cool, thank you. I do, and I have something to say. So,
all right, okay. Well, I think this has been an interesting dive into our own hidden or vestiges of chauvinism. I will say, and if anyone disagrees with me on this, Paul brought up opening doors for women. I open doors for whoever it is that's following me through a door. I don't care if it's a man or a woman, but because of the way our culture has been and because of certain attitudes that existed in previous generations, there is a different context seen when I open a door for someone who happens to be a woman than someone who happens to be a man. But I don't open a door for a woman just because she's a woman and let some guy open the door for himself. Does anybody disagree with me?
Same thing. But I also, when I'm walking up, if I'm walking with a woman, I will step ahead to open the door. And I just always
do that with men?
Yeah, I probably do it with men too, for the most part. Probably more.
Would you let a man open the door for you?
Paul does it for me all the time.
That's true.
I'm not going to comment.
I'm doing my best to open doors for people.
In more ways than one, with your legal practice and everything else. So, okay. Thank you, guys. Thanks for your honesty. And thanks for thinking this stuff through. I know that when we send out the topics, you guys take some time to think it through. And I really appreciate that. And it shows up in your answers as well. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. Andy Willis, good luck with the job on the horse farm.
Thank you. Also, everyone, please, I have to say this to balance what we just talked about male chauvinism.
Yes.
Please, everyone just watch Jan on CTV. It's really important you do, because this show, I guarantee you, is a sleeper. It is like going to be like Schitt's Creek level huge. And people need to just start watching it now. It is beautiful. And it tackles like bisexuality, like from the get-go, of her being like 60 and like a bisexual and like all these like crazy topics, like Alzheimer's, everything, like right in the first couple episodes. So please, everyone, watch.
I saw that Sarah McLachlan scene where her and Sarah McLachlan get into a fight.
Oh, it's hilarious. Yeah. So everyone, please watch Jan on CTV. That's all I have to say and all I have to sell.
All right, then. Byron, I want to thank you for pulling over outside of Hope to share your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much.
Always glad to have you. Aaron Seal in Montreal, thank you again for your erudite summation of your positions.
Always a pleasure to be here. And for those of you listening who aren't listening to our political work, Hafiz and I have a new political podcast called No Ontario, where we discuss provincial politics outside
of Ontario.
Non-Ontario, because everybody talks about Ontario too much. So there's one episode up already, another one coming in the next couple of days. So I'd encourage everyone listening to take a look at that.
Yeah, it's a great show. And people responded to the first one very well. So I'm glad you guys are doing that. It's important to have perspectives from people outside of Ontario, because I think Ontario tends to dominate a little bit. So thank you for doing that show. Which leads us to our producer, Hafiz Noorani. Thank you for putting this show together and for Nontario.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed everything about this FU network.
Great. And Chris Hamilton, thank you very much.
Always a pleasant experience. And just for the record, nobody outside of Ontario ever talks about Ontario. In BC, we generally stick to British Columbian conversation.
Okay, good to know. Not that I would know that. Okay. And of course, Paul Doroshenko. Thank you, Paul, for joining us as usual.
No, it's my pleasure. And as we were recording this podcast, I downloaded the Nontario so I can listen to it immediately.
All right.
Thanks.
All right. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you've enjoyed this program, please consider supporting us on PayPal. It's our email address, funetworktv@gmail.com, or jump on board and become a patron at patreon.com/funetworktv. We really appreciate all the ongoing support you guys have given us. And I haven't really announced this anywhere yet, but I let it slip past. We surpassed for our network over 1 million listens. A little while ago.
What?
Wow. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. And it's because of all of you panelists and because of the people out there who have been helping us with their support and listening to these programs, enjoying them. So and supporting us through PayPal and through Patreon.
If only we had a buck per listen.
Oh,
but talking to you guys out there, buck per listen. Come on.
We had a buck per listen, I think I'd retire. All right.
Well, in that case, make it 25 cents per listen. We need them around a little longer.
All right. Thank you all for listening. This has been Mensplaining. I'm Stephen Kersner on Fun the FU Network. For he's a jolly-